To the Refinery, episode 18, October 14th. Wait, JD's waving at me? Oh, or is he waving at everyone? Okay, sorry. Derp. Okay, everybody vote. Is this a derp or a Hodor moment? That's in honor of
You said a
voting.
holder?
What? Ho
A
derp?
holder.
Ho
Yeah.
okay, so it was a Hoderp.
Synergy.
Yeah. This is in honor of the Google Plus new feature. They allow polls in posts. Kind of a silly thing. And the last answer on every poll must always be Hodor. Anyway, hi, I'm Leslie. I am with the Conservative Union. This is the Refinery, our grassroots collection or confabulation or whatever we are of grassroots organizations talking about conservative messaging. Today we have me and Ryan from the Conservative Union. We have JD and Felicia from Free Radical Network. And our partners at the Party of Choice are out doing Party of Choice things or other stuff and sundry stuff and sundry. What we wanted to start out with today, since we are now officially 4 weeks out from the midterm elections, right? Just four, it's just, no, 3 weeks. Three. 3 weeks, 21 days until these elections are finally here, and then, best for all of us, finally over. It's going to be great to finally get these midterms over and have Harry Reid put out to pasture. Wanted to talk a little bit, just kind of do a little bit of a monologue here of something that I've done at the Conservative Union, which is our community on Google Plus. I created a category in the Conservative Union to which any of the Conservative Union members can post, and the category name is Campaign 2014. And what I want there is campaign ads. It's not a place for us to discuss the candidates. It's a place for us to post and, to create a post that has the candidate's YouTube ad or an article about them or something that is promoting the candidate. And ideally, you put a link also to the candidate's website, maybe a link to that state's voter registration information, and you format it such that it is a social media friendly post that is promotion for the candidate. And you just post it there, and that allows everybody else who is a member of the Conservative Union or who sees it on Google Plus, and it also gets cross-posted to Twitter and Facebook. It allows people to just click and reshare to their people, trying to help us promote these candidates in a fast and efficient way. Everybody's busy, and I don't have the chance to look up all of the gubernatorial candidates in Florida, but Marla did a great job today with writing up a nice post about Rick Scott, and I was able to just click, reshare that. And so now all the people who follow me, who may not also follow Marla, all the people who follow me can see this nice little campaign ad about Rick Scott. And that means we can quickly and easily expand the messaging beyond that paid for messaging that the candidates do of TV and radio ads and phone calls and stuff that George Will was talking on Fox News earlier today. That's kind of, that market is kind of saturated. There's an awful lot of TV ads and radio ads that people are seeing. But what they haven't seen is their friend on Facebook telling them how great Scott Brown is and why they should vote for Scott Brown in New Hampshire. They haven't seen their Twitter friend mentioning vote for Jeff Bell in New Jersey. And that's going to be a little bit more noticed than yet another ad from candidate for Senate, whatever. So it, I think at this point it does make more sense for us to spend some time putting together an ad for a candidate that you care about and you like, and you just put it in a format that's reshare friendly. So, all you have to do is click, and you've reshared it to everybody. And it seemed to, just in the first few hours, we already got contributions from other people creating items for candidates that they know about. Of course, I mean, I hammered it first with the Senate candidates that I've been tracking, but other people started adding stuff about some of the candidates that they're looking at. So it seemed like it went pretty well. What do y'all think?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a really good forum for us to discuss the myriad races, and or well, not discuss the races so much as make sure that all of the content generated about those races is out there. And you know, you're absolutely right in saying that, you know, it's kind of tired to see these same old ads trotted out every year, you know, every 2 years, whatever, you know, hitting the Democrat or hitting the Republican, whatever. Instead, that's not how we even advertise anymore. If you think about Yelp, if you think about the importance of social media in marketing these days, it's really become a lot about user generated.
Just endorse that guy. It's endorsement.
Yeah, exactly. It's the hey, here's this great thing that I ate at this restaurant. You guys should totally go there because it's awesome. You should be able to do the same thing with candidates. This is some great stuff that Jeff Bell is talking about. So, you know, check him out. This is an important candidate. And, you know, I enjoyed what he was talking about. So here, please watch this. Taking this, you know, social is the next step for us in the political game. And the left has already done that. I mean, the left has done that to a very, you know, large extent. That's something that they're good at.
And one thing for us to always remember is that the left will talk politics to everyone. They will talk politics to their cooking friends, to their school friends, to the people who know them for their flower decorations. And we tend to isolate and segment our friends. And, I only talk politics in my politics group. I don't talk politics at work. Or I don't talk politics to my sports friends. Well, why not?
Well,
is the country not important enough for you to take that risk?
That's a really good question. And I mean, to bring it into that sports realm, I'm a Jets fan. I'm going to talk about the Jets, well, maybe not this year, but I'm going to talk about the Jets to Patriots fans, and I'm not going to second guess myself there. I'm a passionate Jets fan, and I'm going to hit the Patriots on whatever it is that I can hit them on. I'm not scared to do that. You shouldn't be scared to do that from a just a Republican Democrat perspective. Even if you don't, I mean, we talk about messaging here. You don't want to be a jerk about it. I probably am more likely to be a jerk about the Patriots than I am about the Democrats. So, you know, it's about moderation, but it's an important step to make.
Well, and I do hear a lot of people hesitate to talk about politics in certain arenas, and also we conservatives have a habit of talking politics only when it's near an election. We're like those Sunday I go to church and talk about God, but I don't talk about God any other time. We call those, you know, just the Sunday or Christmas and Easter Christians. We are November 4th. Republicans, that's or November 4th conservatives, we need to remember that politics is nothing more or less than the rules structuring our society. And that means that it matters more than just one day of the year, and that it's perfectly valid for us to discuss it all the time, anywhere. It's a perfectly valid topic.
I think so many people still have ingrained in them that you don't talk about politics or religion in polite company. And for the
right,
same
reason. Right, but I was raised, you don't talk about politics, religion, and sex in polite company. But we talk about sex all the freaking time.
Well, you might.
Well, I don't. But you look at TV and newspapers, and it's always mentioned.
But that's a different thing. It's out there in the discussion realm, but are we, as conservatives, contributing to it? That's a different thing. That's and true. So I think a lot of us were raised that way. Now, I wasn't. I wasn't. But I know a lot of people who are, and I interact with a lot of people who are. And it's just, it's a difficult barrier for them to get over. I understand that. I hate that the left has driven politics into every aspect of life to where everything from what you buy to where you eat is politicized. And that, if that is the ground that we're on and we're going to hold on to our polite, you know, non-offensive presence and not fight back and by at least showing up to the discussion, we're going to get mowed over. It's just going to happen.
I mean, if it's something that Cory Gardner needs to take into account, if it's something that, you know, we talked about this last week, if it's something that the candidates need to pay attention to, and be aware that you need to go on the attack sometimes, you need to, you know, go out and speak for your values and what you actually believe in, then we should probably figure out how to do that in, you know, mixed company and in not just our conservative bubbles. So that would be a really nice thing. I mean, I've written about this a billion years ago. We've had this discussion, a few times back before the refinery was the refinery. But getting out there and realizing that you're not going to, you know, turn to stone for saying that you like a politician or for saying that you are going to be voting one way or the other. You know, are there repercussions? Yeah,
but maybe.
Think about it. Think about it like rooting for your football team.
Well, and the thing is, particularly with midterms, there's an awful lot of the population that doesn't pay attention to politics much at all. We're pretty obsessed with it. But there's an awful lot of population that is really only dimly aware of politics in terms of presidential elections. But they care. They just don't pay attention. They're focused to other stuff. But mid-October through November, I mean, we've got it's a three-week period here. Many of them are possibly hearing, oh, midterms are coming up. I haven't heard anything about that. I don't know what to do. Wonder what's going on. And so if you bring it up, they're like, oh, that's right. This is, when is that? Oh, that's the, okay, Tuesday? And is it really important for me to go vote? So this is a close race, I should go? Oh, well, thank you. Thanks for reminding me. I really appreciate that.
There are people who feel that, yes.
There are plenty of people who feel that. Plenty.
And I want to say something about that, too, to getting conservatives really motivated here. For the reasons that you just spoke about, in politics, people are seeking one of two things: to impose their will on someone else or to defend themselves from someone else imposing their will upon them. Which philosophy do you think that the left and progressives is engaging in? It's the one trying to impose things on people, control people. We talk about that all the time. On the conservative side, we're playing defense for a lot of reasons, one of which is we'd just like to have less government to deal with. We would like less intrusion. We would like government to matter less. But because we want government to matter less, politics must matter more to us.
Yep. If you're ever going to get involved, this is the best time to. There's an article I read today from Thomas Sowell in townhall.com. It's about local or national elections. And he shares a quote that says all politics is local. They said there are a few elections that are national, are a big enough issue that it affects the whole nation and affects the future. He talks about one being the election in 1860 and talking about how that was to get rid of slavery. It was an issue that the whole nation faced and everyone could come together on something like that. And he mentions that this midterm election is the same type of thing, that we have, if Obama controls the Senate, he will be able to appoint 3 Supreme Court justices, and it's a lifelong appointment.
And so numerous federal judges below the Supreme Court, too. So.
Yeah, and we've already seen how he's willing to go around the traditional government, you know, Congress and the Senate with unilateral executive orders and word games that go to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court is judging and kind of making law, legislating from the bench, instead of just enforcing what's there. And if he gets his way to appoint 3 more liberal judges, there's not going to be anything that's going to be able to stop them. whether, even if a conservative gets in, the Supreme Court can just overrule pretty much whatever they want, and they'd have a solid majority. So this is a very, very important time to get involved, to pay attention, and to let everyone you know how important it is, so that, you know, we keep the system of government that we have set up where there are checks and balances.
And he makes a few points in the it was a pretty short article, that because Obama understands so deeply what the stakes are, that's why he's spending so much time fundraising. And it doesn't bother him that the other candidates don't want him to campaign for them. He's fine with that. He will do his fundraising and make sure that the Democrats can continue to have their leftist agenda proceed, and it will outlast Barack Obama. And that means that I didn't even read Paul Krugman's article, but I read the headline where he says that Barack Obama is the most significant president we've ever had or whatever, and people were laughing at that, but it's actually true. Because Barack Obama has succeeded at what he wanted to do, and his impact will be felt for a very long time. It will be much harder to unwind what Barack Obama and his leftist progressives have done than it was to unwind what Ronald Reagan did. So in a sense, you know, Krugman was right, and Barack Obama understands this. The left understands this, and they're always fighting, and they're always pushing their agenda via whatever candidate they have. They don't get as focused on the specifics of the candidates. They are very much more about their agenda, and they will attack our candidates, but they're almost always attacking our agenda. And we tend to defend our candidates and attack their candidates, and we tend to not attack their agenda, and we tend to not promote our agenda. So it's easy to see how, when I'm trying to put together advertising type of posts for particular candidates, what I end up seeing is that people on our own side, their comment is not, okay, great, I'm going to reshare that and advertise this Republican candidate. Their comment is about how this particular Republican candidate is less than ideal. Or their comment is about how the Democrat candidate they're opposing is bad. It's, they're kind of, we tend to get wrapped up in the personalities and lose focus on the larger agenda at stake.
The scoreboard. We don't look at the scoreboard. We look at the personal stats. And as a person who follows sports, personal stats are nice, but you can have somebody do wonderfully in padding their stats and still have that team lose the game. And we are not in a position where we can afford to lose the game at this point. So we need to get over this obsession.
Yeah, because at this point, for the next 3 weeks, I don't care who the candidate is. As long as he's got an R behind his name, he should be voted for. Vote for him. If he's a Republican, vote for him. I don't care.
There's a paragraph in this article where Sol talks about how far Obama's willing to go. He's talking about ISIS. He says, foreign policy is subordinated to Obama's overriding ideological vision. The president will not risk losing this year's congressional elections by taking military actions that will alienate his political base. Token military actions can minimize the political losses for voters. That people will die while he stalls on military action is a price he's willing to pay. His ordering thousands of American troops into Ebola-infested Liberia shows the same ideologically driven callousness. He's willing to let people die. He's willing to cover up, lie, you know, not close the border when Ebola is coming through because he's got fundraisers to do. He doesn't want to look mean. He's willing to do whatever it takes to win.
And do half measures on ISIS. He's going to do a little bombing campaign, and that will satisfy the people who want him to be a fighter tough guy, but he's not going to bomb a whole lot, risk having civilian casualties or anything that blows back on him. And because he doesn't really care about ISIS, he's not going to do enough to really stop them. His whole point is not to stop ISIS. He doesn't care about that. He cares about pushing the Democrat agenda, yeah. always, every day.
It's scary how many people he's willing to put in harm's way or let die to pass his agenda, to not look bad, to have good optics on something.
Right, and we need to make sure that we emphasize the, you know, how just how bad the situation is. Maybe not by going through those specifics about Obama, but make it larger, you know, the larger argument against, the larger case against the Democrats. Because, you know, when we are talking about those single candidates or talking about a single person on the left, it's easy to say, oh, you just hate black people, or, oh, you think that, you know, you're probably one of those crazy Tea Partiers that thinks that Obama's a Kenyan or some stuff like that. Go through, you know, you could go through the entire list of candidates that the Democrats have. And find something that they could use and say, oh, well, your opinion doesn't matter because you must be one of those types of Republicans that are, you know, sexist or racist or whatever, blatantly untrue. But when you're fighting against the party as a whole, when you're fighting against what they're doing as a whole, it makes it a lot easier to point out the specifics of the policy fails instead of having this identity politics, which we lose on a you know, regular basis. And speaking of identity politics, there is a Republican identity politics that we do have, that we hero worship our candidates, and you know, we don't think that they can do or say anything wrong. I think Fishy this is kind of a topic that Fishy has pushed a lot in the past about, you know, just how awkward it is to be able to try and win an election when, instead of pushing the policies, you're focused too much on the candidate himself. So,
well, part of that, the reason that I've always objected to that is, A, your principles far outlast any candidate that's going to be put up for something. And B, we've seen candidates, you know, change with the wind occasionally about what they do, but a solidly anchored candidate who has behind him not just some good support, but good accountability partners in his constituents who will come to him and regularly communicate what they expect and what they want, and say, you know, we're not going to take it if you take that position. We're going to make a stink, and we're going to make you look bad, and eventually we're going to find someone to run against you. They need that accountability because they're human, they're fallible, and they are apt to be swayed by certain things, and we can't afford that. When you concentrate on the person, a person will let you down. The principles, the values that we share, the things that we want to run on, those outlast any campaign, any person, and they're cultural in nature more than political in nature. When you get down to it, the things we're talking about are cultural touchstones that we want to have a society that that is ordered a certain way, that we have values that are championed in our lives, that we want government to be as small as possible so that it's not as intrusive. All those things that we fight for, if you find one candidate who doesn't do it for you, you can get that guy switched out with someone else who will do a better job. But if you're focused just on the candidate, you're going to suffer heartbreak after heartbreak after heartbreak because they will let you down. How many times have we heard people say, oh, I was with so-and-so all the way until this one vote, until this one thing they did? Yeah, you hit them on that one thing and you tell them that they did wrong. But the general principles that we want to advance have a far better chance of getting there, even with sloppy, second-rate, you know, B-team candidates, if we're willing to put the effort in to keep them accountable and get them elected and then re-elected if they are accountable and if they are good. That's where I've always been coming from for there. Those candidates are not what you want to hang your hat on. It's the values.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the person today who I saw that put this way better than I can is Dennis Prager. He tends to do that really well. He puts things in a non-vitriolic fashion. He really makes his point, and he doesn't beat you over the head with it. too much. And what he talks about in this article is don't vote for the candidate. I mean, he specifically was saying what Felicia was just talking about. You know, many Americans have this noble-sounding attitude when they say, I vote for the candidate, and it definitely sounds good. He says, voting for the best candidate rather than the party sounds as American as apple pie. But since the Democrat Party has become a doctrinaire left-wing party, this sentiment is no longer noble. It is actually foolish and dangerous. And then he goes back to a time when there were some terrific Democrats that a moderate or an independent or even a Republican could consider voting for depending on where they lived. And he specifically mentions Democrats that I think all of us remember fondly, Lieberman and Moynihan. If I lived in Connecticut, I could have voted for Lieberman. Easy. Respected the man. He respected America. We were on the same page on a good number of things. But those guys are gone. They've been chased out of the Democrat Party. And he reminds us that regarding the most destructive legislation in modern American history, this would be Obamacare, the candidate didn't mean a thing. Party meant everything. Obamacare has changed the nation, and it was strictly political parties that made it happen. The specific candidates didn't matter. All those who decided, oh, you know what, Norm Coleman really isn't a strong enough Republican for me, I'm going to stay home, and they let Al Franken get elected, they made Obamacare happen just because they decided Norm Coleman wasn't quite good enough for them. And then he talks about how our tendency, what I had mentioned before, our tendency to have our candidates will campaign against the other candidate rather than against the other party. Had Mitt Romney constantly repeated that he was not merely running against Barack Obama the man, but against Barack Obama, the most left-wing president in American history, you know, that election could have turned out differently. But he didn't. He never made the election about ideology or party. Instead, he made it about individuals. And that's quite dangerous because our individuals are no more saintly than their individuals, and our individuals are no more terrible than their individuals. Well, okay, our individuals are better than theirs, but objectively better, I think so. But that becomes a he said, she said, and becomes a very transient thing, and it becomes a battle that you have to fight every single election. If we can convert ourselves to thinking about campaigning against their ideology and for our ideology, then our campaign tactics and messaging can last throughout the year because the people involved don't really matter. It's more the policy and the procedures and the ideology. And he closes with something that I thought was really powerful, so I'm just going to read it. Why doesn't every Republican candidate remind voters that the Democrat Party supported the complete withdrawal of American troops from Iraq and that this made the Islamic State possible? Either the left succeeds or America succeeds.
Well, and, you know, that brings up something that I've been wanting to talk about. It's the left tactics.
Mm-hmm.
When we see, and you just mentioned Obamacare, that was a great example. When we see this administration so willing to revise, and this is mentioned in some of the articles, revise at will, different legislation, and without altering the legislation itself, just executive ordering their way through whatever they'd like to have, regardless of Congress, declare war without Congress, without declaring war, that sort of thing. This is not an aberration. This presidency is not an aberration. These tactics are not an aberration.
He's better at it than any of the guys of the past had been. And that's why it seems an aberration, because he's doing it all at once.
And it's not just that he's better at it. It's that his team, the entire team, has a clear, a very clear understanding of what this is about, mm-hmm. of what's at stake. and that they must prevail at any cost and will do anything. We talked about last week how Alison Grimes' campaign people were saying, oh, she's lying on supporting coal. As soon as she gets elected, it doesn't matter anymore. She'll do whatever she wants. She'll do whatever the Democrats want. But we have to say that she supports coal because this is Kentucky and voters are stupid. We talked about that as a tactic. This is not, again, an isolated thing. What you find, and there's a couple of stories that support this in Texas that are going on right now. The first of which, we've had a voter ID bill passed last year, and it was in effect in...
I think it was passed in 2012. It was passed in 2012 and was in effect in the 2013 elections.
Right. So I went to training. I'm an election judge. I went to training. I learned how to effectively handle ID for people. It has added maybe a couple of minutes to voting for people that might not have had an ID, but it was not a huge burden from the perspective of the voters or from ours. We got a lot of voter rolls straightened out that way, too. Then the Democrats challenged it legally. And we've done a lot in Texas to make sure that everybody had ID. They've even created something that I was hoping they would, mobile ID vans. You could get free ID, and the state would bring a van that had all the equipment that was going to help you get that. If you were in an impoverished position, if you couldn't go and take care of an ID yourself or couldn't afford one, the state made arrangements for that. I don't know specifically what they were, but the state made arrangements to deal with that. But the lawsuit happened, and so this week we've heard that voter ID in Texas is now not going to pass. It's been stayed because of a judge's decision. And then we hear today that stay has been reversed and that now voter ID will be in effect in this November's election in Texas, the voter ID law that we had passed. And so I'm getting kind of whiplash over this. But the point being that even if you pass a law, even if you depend on your guys in that you've elected, however good or bad, to get the law passed that you want or to revoke and repeal some laws that are bad, that's not the end of it because the Democrats will not give up. They will launch immediately into lawsuits. Why is the lawsuit arena better for them? Appointed judges. This makes total sense to me that the number one priority ought to be replacing all the Democrats, firing Harry Reid from his majority leadership position, and taking the Senate, and then in 2016 focusing everything we have on gaining the executive position in the presidency so that we do not have any more of those judges appointed. But going back to what I guess the ground is, how many judges they have appointed already, it's going to take years to cycle through all those judges and get them all out and replace them with conservative Republican appointments. So one election in one presidential year is not going to do it. There's also, just on the local level here in Houston, the Houston Equal Rights Ordinance, which the mayor passed, which is like equal access to bathrooms for transgendered people. You know, I don't even know all the details of this thing, but it was supposed to allow, you know, transgendered or people in the middle of elective surgery to use an opposite sex bathroom. And people on the right handled their opposition so miserably. Instead of talking about the businesses and the burdens on it, they started talking about predators and they started talking about sex offenders, and it was just a really nasty fight. And the churches got involved, the pastors' council got involved. And so now, in the middle of this lawsuit where they were attempting to put this issue on the ballot and let the people actually decide rather than the city just creating an ordinance, now that there's been a lawsuit about it, the mayor and the city's lawyers are now subpoenaing the sermon notes, the sermons from pastors, not even in that pastor council that opposed this, to use that as part of discovery. the tactic there is to overwhelm the side that's in opposition to this ordinance with everything they can think of, flooding them with paperwork, attempting to harass them, compel them to produce sermons and whatnot. Okay, this is typical. This is not anything out of the ordinary. This is how the left fights. And if we have any argument from the beginning of the show about people not wanting to be involved in politics, they're getting bored, they're getting overwhelmed, they don't think it matters, it matters. This is the proof. They don't give up. And I'm sorry, people, that politics is becoming 24/7, 365, but that's the choice. People in politics are either going to do one of two things. Take all of your your freedom and try to, use power over you, to exercise power over you, or you're going to be on defense and you're going to be attempting to keep them from exercising power on you.
So it's not glamorous to play defense, but no. That's what we are. And that's what the conservative movement is all about, is defending against the encroachments of selfish people who put themselves in government so that they can take your stuff.
Just take your stuff for them either. They're going to do it with good conscience because they're taking it for somebody else.
Because they care. And that the Houston ordinance thing, it's from start to finish, it's an example of the way the left operates. It started out with the mayor made an executive order. And then there was enough pushback against, you don't really have, you're not like the king of Houston or queen, whichever. There was enough pushback that, okay, well, we'll have city council rule on this thing. So she's our mayor is very powerful, and she can pretty much get anything through city council that she wants. But she did decide, okay, well, we'll follow the rules and we'll get city council to pass this ordinance. Well, city council passed the ordinance, and the way the Houston charter is set up, the citizens of the city have the opportunity to petition their government if they disagree with. Within 30 days, they can get a certain number of signatures on a petition to have it be reviewed or overturned, or to actually then push that resolution goes out to a referendum or for a vote. So because they thought that there would be enough people that we could get a petition signed to maybe push this thing out to a referendum rather than just being a city council ordinance. So then the Council of Churches gathered together and they needed 17,000 signatures. They got 50,000 signatures. Took all of those signatures to the city attorney. She was counting through and validating, and she got up to about 19,000 and said, okay, that's enough. We've made the threshold. Take that upstairs to the mayor and her people. Well, the mayor and her people came up with some bogus excuse to throw out those signatures and to invalidate the fact that citizens of Houston had requested, had followed the procedures to request a referendum on this thing rather than city council ordaining it. They threw that out. And then that triggered a lawsuit, that did trigger a lawsuit against the city, right? There is a current lawsuit pending? I'm not really sure.
Right, right, which is where the discovery process comes in as the city is attempting to, punch
defend
back.
Itself or something? They're pushing back on the pastors and the churches who had the audacity to protest against the city of Houston. And what's so interesting is that all of the pastors and the churches that came together, as most of us who are honest with ourselves understand, black churches are not gay friendly. Black churches oppose gay marriage probably more so than the big white evangelical churches. And there were an awful lot of black pastors opposed to this gay ordinance, or the equality ordinance or whatever they're calling it. But in this suit that the mayor brought today, all of the subpoenas, and it isn't just a request for information. These are legal subpoenas for the churches to provide their sermons and all of the communications that they had with their congregations about Mayor Parker and I think even the topic of homosexuality and the topic of transgenderism. I mean, it's pretty broad. But they only subpoenaed the conservative white churches. They did not subpoena that information from any of the black churches. And they did that because they don't want to make the black pastors angry and because they're betting that the conservative white churches will be, oh, gosh, this is bad. Oh, my goodness. Felicia, isn't it? Did you hear? That's just terrible. Well, what's that? Wow, that's just too bad, but okay. And then they'll move on to the next thing and not protest. But if they had violated the First Amendment rights of the black churches would not be sitting down and taking it. And that's where actually Jared Woodfill, former Harris County Republican Party chair, is one of the lawyers who's like being sued. He's a party to one of the lawsuits, and he's a lawyer on one of the other ones. And Michael Berry had him on the radio kind of explaining it and talking about it a little bit today. But as he said, they're fighting it. They're going to fight these subpoenas. None of the churches are actually going to be turning over this information. They're protesting the subpoenas, and they will fight it as far and as high as they have to, because these are serious encroachments upon freedom of speech.
Now, I want to make a point that the sermons themselves are public information. Mm-hmm. That is something you can buy a copy of in the bookstores, most churches, things like that. It isn't that the churches are hiding information that cannot be gotten in another way. It is that they are being compelled to produce that. And if the emails and things like that are also, any church emails that are going out are also under subpoena, that's something even more frightening. I cannot express how uneasy that makes me and how uneasy it should make everybody about that.
And the whole thing is the left pushing as far as they can, and they're pushing beyond the rules and regulations to see what they can get away with. And we let them get away with an awful lot. And they keep pushing because they know at some point we will get tired, we will get bored, and we will leave the field, and they can then score their touchdown.
Yeah, because it doesn't matter. The two parties are so alike. It's, you know.
Ugh.
No, I mean, but seriously, it's a shame that we have people who are Republicans and who want to vote, but are distracted by the idea that, oh, well, there's nothing that we can do. Even if we do get our guys elected, even if we do get our Republicans elected, that, you know, we aren't going to be able to succeed because we have people like the president who will come in and immediately legislate from his position of power through executive orders that, you know, even if we were to get the Senate, it doesn't matter anyway because the president is just going to use his pen and his phone to change the situation and to counter any laws that we may try and put up.
I think, too, it's like exercising a muscle. If you get into the habit of fighting, if you get into the habit of standing up for the values that we share, then it becomes easier to do it, and you get smarter about doing it, and you learn how to do it better. If you just show up every once in a while to the gym, you're not going to make any progress, but if you're faithful and you go on a regular basis, you're going to see results. I think that politics can work the same way. If we are exercising those muscles, we're getting better. You find that the same people are, you know, in the consultant class, per se, and hired over and over for different campaigns because they have experience. We need that as well. We need a lot of it, and we need to do that sort of ongoing, positive, moving forward, attempting to find races where we can win and where we can help, prioritizing our efforts, but concentrating on exercising the muscles that it takes to be involved in politics more often, more effectively, and we need to constantly be learning. We need to not just sit back and rest on, okay, this is what I know how to do, and that's all I'm going to know how to do. Those folks on the left, they are compartmentalized and able to do plenty of things because there are 11 organizations that are supporting the Democrats themselves. We don't have that luxury. So we need to learn to be a little bit more jack of all trades. We need to make phone calls, and we need to walk blocks, and we need to talk to friends, and we need to help candidates with their social media, all of those things. Because we don't have paid people on our side in the ranks that they do. We just don't.
And as a person who's recently done all of those things, it's really not that difficult. And from a local level, I mean, yeah, they're looking for that. That's something that people are starved for. Candidates are starved for any kind of interaction, any kind of support. So, I mean, not only do these elections matter, but there are things that you can actually make an impact on. And the way that we get better advisors, the way that we get those people, the way that we don't fail because of advisors who eventually go on to create ads like Republicans are people too with the stock photos, we get that experience from the local level up, and you need to start on the local level if you intend to make it anywhere. If you want to make a better Republican Party, the best place to start is on the ground, because if you want to get noticed by somebody on the Senate level, if you don't have anything going on in your background, you know, who are you? You don't have anything. So start on the local level, and those guys will, sing your praises and keep on going. That's how it works.
One point I too wanted to make, we talked about whether it's hopeless or not, and people having, getting discouraged over the state of affairs when you can ignore laws and do what you want if you're in power. We are, okay, one thing, and that's it. The bureaucrats that are in charge of implementing these things and the judges that are appointed to hear these cases are not put there by the losers, period.
Exactly. Lead, follow, or get out of the way. And if you feel like there's two phrases that go on in my head all the time because I get discouraged and demoralized quite frequently. People who believe it's useless, it's pointless, we're going to lose anyway, no matter, even if we win, he's going to override and do his executive orders and all of that kind of stuff. That's a team that is playing a football game and they're behind by 20 points and they've decided that they're going to lose and they just walk off the field. Well, okay, that's fine. If you want to do that, then that you've declared that you are a get out of the way person. Please get out of my way, because you know what? I'm going to keep fighting. I may be losing, and we've been losing a lot, and it gets very frustrating. But we won't always lose, and I want to make sure that we're prepared when we can start winning. And just because we are losing doesn't mean I'm going to give up. And if you are going to give up, then get out of politics and go pay attention to football or baking or basket weaving and just leave me alone. Because if you, by continuing to be Debbie Downer on what I'm doing and in my arena, you're dragging me down and you're actually causing harm. You're making my side worse by talking about how it's not possible and it's a failure and being a pessimist. And don't you understand the challenges that we have facing us? Oh, trust me. I totally understand the challenges we have facing us. But I have to believe that we can win, because otherwise why would I even be trying? And if you either lead, follow, or get out of my damn way.
Yeah, and the thing is that these elections matter. Even if Obama, you know, decides tomorrow that we're giving free cake to everybody who crosses the border, you know, that's fine. But there are going to be consequences. We can still do things if we have the Senate. The way that we improve the country is through winning. That's it. There's no full stop. We
exactly.
have to win first. And if you don't think that winning is going to help, you're flat out wrong. You are absolutely wrong. It is absolutely worth it to go out and vote, to get out there and change the status quo in the Senate, because there are things that can be accomplished. You are lying to yourself and making yourself feel better. Oh, well, I'm not going to vote because it doesn't matter, because they're just going to do it anyway. You're making yourself you're absolving yourself of the guilt of actually, you know, working on campaigns and trying to get stuff done and trying to get people elected. And that's shameful.
And culturally it matters too. When you go out and talk to people and they believe that elections don't matter, it suppresses voter turnout, all that sort of thing, which is a bad thing in and of itself. People can argue about shouldn't want to register this kind of person or that kind of crap on that. No, we need to be registering people. They need to be engaged in their government, and they need to feel it, because the people who don't feel it and who don't pay attention are the ones, a lot of them, that are letting this stuff slide. And that brings up another story that we've been wanting to talk about. We tabled it last week because of time, but again, tactics of the left, not electoral tactics this time, but cultural tactics. And that is the story about the swatting, the false reports of people open carrying guns. JD, you want to intro that one?
Yeah, I'll do that. It's really a frustrating thing. For people who don't know what swatting is, I'll just quickly say it's where you call the cops and say that something bad is happening at a particular location, and, you know, immediately we need help. We need help. So, you know, call 911, do all of that stuff erroneously. You're doing that, not erroneously, you're doing it with the express purpose of scaring the living daylights or causing harm to whomever, you know, you're doing this on, wherever the location is that you're calling it on. This leads to people, I mean, we've seen conservative journalists have this happen to them, where in the middle of the night they get woken up and there are cops, you know, in their house pointing guns at them. I mean, this is serious stuff. This is absolutely terrifying. So what's even more terrifying is that on the Moms Demand Action group, you know, that's that, we've talked about that before. They were the ones who had that ridiculously horrible ad sponsored by Michael Bloomberg. These people, not the main group itself, but the people commenting on their Facebook page, supporters of Moms Demand Action, have been repeatedly saying that, hey, if you know somebody who open carries, if you know somebody who has a gun, then call them, you know, SWAT them, call 911 and say that this person is you know, doing something, you know, you heard a scream or whatever, and there's bad stuff happening, so that the cops come in and see somebody with a gun. I mean, the as bad as the waking up to see a police officer with a gun in your face, as bad as that is, hopefully, you know, if you aren't perceived as a threat, then things, you know, hopefully will calm down. But if you're perceived as a threat in your own house, and you know, what's the first thing that you do if you are somebody who, if you're a gun owner and some armed person breaks into your house, what do you do? What do you do? What's the correct response? So
you defend yourself. You absolutely defend yourself. Period.
And that's what makes this so incredibly deadly and scary and terrifying, is the fact that they're trying to use this tactic of swatting to, and they go, they outright say that who cares if they get killed because they should, they deserve to get shot because they're gun owners. It's absolutely disgusting.
There's been a story in the news, and I haven't been following it closely, but a African-American man was in a store like a Walmart or something. He had a BB gun, and someone called the cops. Cops came in and shot him and killed him. And the article mentions this story, and it mentions that the 911 call, they matched up the timestamp with the timestamp of the surveillance. And the 911 call is saying, yeah, he's brandishing this weapon, he's threatened two children, he's pointing it at everyone in the store, he's wild, he's crazy. And when you look at the timestamp of the surveillance from that, he's got the gun pointed at the ground, it's a toy gun, he's not attacking anyone, he's not approaching anyone. And it seems from that evidence that this person was just swatting the guy to make a point, to make a national news story, to get their cause out, or whatever they were trying to do. But mm-hmm. I mean, that's the intent of this and the goal of this.
That is what is so evil about this, and the people that are that committed to limiting gun rights, that they will cause irreparable harm and death in some cases to people for exercising the rights because they do not like the way they are being exercised. If you had any doubt about what we're against, what we're up against on the left, that right there should tell you everything you need to know.
No, this type of thing has always been a tactic of the big government and of the left. They want to control you. They think that they know better than you how to live your life, and they will do anything up into including killing someone to get people to live according to what they think is best. And we've seen it all over and over again throughout history. And we're seeing some on the left with that same thing now, where they're willing to get people killed just to start a discussion or to start something to promote their ideas.
To control what you do. And that's what it is, that this is a righteous thing. They feel righteous in doing this. It's absurd, the kind of mindset that these people have. It's like, I mean, I really don't want to violate certain laws of the internet, but you know, at some point you have to talk about desiring people to be killed because of their ideology. I mean, that's what we're talking about. That's what these people are explicitly talking about in these posts.
And the left loves to talk about limits on free speech, fire in a crowded theater. If this is not the same category as fire in a crowded theater, I don't know what is. This is blatantly endangering people just because you disagree.
And it's hard to trace these things too, because you know, a lot of the calls that get made through VoIP that gets bounced across, you know, the internet, so that the people who, you know, the 911 operators aren't exactly sure where these calls are coming from or whatever. It's easy to mask these calls, and it's hard to get a location on who it was that did it initially. It's sickening though that this is an underreported story, that you know, I haven't heard about this anywhere really. It's not something that gets talked about. It certainly doesn't get talked about as much as whatever absurd thing that Wayne LaPierre says every second Friday. You know, it's ridiculous that this side of the gun control debate, if we want to talk about it like that, it's not a debate in the media. It's not. It's a one-sided, just, you know, like we said before, the left is tireless, and you know, when it comes to pushing their goals, we don't hear about this part of the equation. We only hear about the stupid stuff that the right says.
Right, instead of the dangerous stuff the left says.
The and deadly stuff.
Right. We can talk about the I guess, the religion of left ideology and, you know, the church of the progressive sometime and all the rites and rituals that go with that. We'll have to save that after the election. We'll have to come back to that.
And when Andy's here to tell us.
Yes!
Because he was an insider.
Yes. He could probably perform all the rituals if he wanted him, you know, with all the accoutrement that go with it, you know. I don't know.
He needs to wear the robes. I'm sure there are robes, right?
Yes.
Probably.
Right.
Maybe a tree hugging or something.
From all that tactic-wise, I definitely want us to get into what I think is a little bit lighter sort of subject, and that is how the Democrats are doing at fundraising. This is kind of funny. Jon Stewart actually hammered on the Democrats' generated fundraising emails this cycle. He did maybe an 8-minute piece on it on his show where he details the emails that he's been getting. The actual email headlines are such that we keep emailing. Biden, Joe Biden has emailed you. Michelle's emailed you. And now I'm emailing you, talking about, you know, a personal email from Barack Obama with his name on it, that sort of thing. Good point, JD. Bring that up in a second. Another email heading, we've got nothing left.
Oh, my God, it's so scary. How crab.
Oh, my God. Great. And then here's one, all hope is lost. These are actual headings of emails that they're sending out on the left. And we're done. Go home. Give up.
Oh, okay.
This is what they're using. And then, of course, Jon Stewart brings up the point. He's like, so how much do you need, you know, to prevent this, you know, suicidal sort of you know, communications continuing to come? How much do you need? And it's like, click down at the bottom of the email, $5. Now, a lot of other people have noticed this pattern in the recent past with Democrats. I have people who are on Democrat mailing lists who publish those on a regular basis so that we can laugh at them. The tactic was successful in 2012. They had a lot of people that were very energized and willing to open their pocketbooks, but this is an off-year election. People aren't as excited. There's no Barack Obama to carry other candidates across the finish line. And, you know, Jon Stewart is making the point that they're getting completely ridiculous, even down to where he says, one of these emails says, according to our records, you haven't chipped in yet. And his next sentence, I swear, and this is why I thought this was so fun, and made a good point culturally, I guess we know now what the NSA data center's for. That's hilarious. He hits on not only the emails and the Democrats putting that out, but he ties that to the NSA.
Nice.
You know, that's beautiful. Nice. Isn't it great when once in a while you can take a moment and have Jon Stewart actually do a little bit of a dig that makes a point that millions of people are going to see that haven't been watching anything, and then they get that NSA tag in this, and they go, what is he talking about? I wonder. Wait, I heard my crazy right-wing friend talk about the NSA. I wonder. I'll ask.
That's why we need to make sure that our non-political friends know that we are the political expert that they know. Yes. And that we are the sane and rational and nice and friendly conservative political expert that they know, so that they will ask us.
Yes,
be the resource.
Goes back to the whole don't be a jerk about it conversation from before. Yes.
I always think back to Swayze with the be nice. Be nice. I think of Swayze as often as possible, but that's my own thing.
Swayze, he's a rapper, right? Swayze, yeah.
Blocked and reported. Oh, my God. If I had the Hangout sound effects, I would have so given you all of the nasty sound effects. I'm going to look for them now.
Hey, it's just it's the truth. I'm surprised that that we didn't preface this subject by saying that John Stewart destroys the left on their emails, because that's always how these stories go. Of course, it's John Stewart destroying people because, you know, that's he's the grand destroyer of all things. He's destroyed everything like 5 times already, according to Mediaite.
Well, and nobody ever comments on or discusses anything. Good, it's all you just destroy.
Yeah. I think that the bringing up of Mediaite is a pretty good segue here into something else that we wanted to talk about. We watched that clip of John Stewart. We did. It was funny. And I'm not complaining about it. It was a funny clip, and it did make an interesting point about the NSA, like you said, Fishy. But I didn't have any problem watching it, even though I despise John Stewart. I'm not a fan at all. You can read some of the stuff that I've written on freeradicalnetwork.com. Look in my archives. There's plenty of it there that I'm not thrilled with the guy.
But wait a minute. You just confessed to having watched John Stewart from the Mediaite website?
Yes.
Is that true? You have admitted to this?
I've done that, yeah.
You are a traitor to the conservative movement.
No, I'm not, and that's the thing. That's what I'm trying to get at, is that...
Don't you know those are liberal sites? Don't you know?
I know. I know. And I am a rhino, I guess. I don't know. No, I don't have a problem. I don't have a problem at all. If there's something that is interesting on Slate, if there's something interesting on The Daily Beast, if there's something interesting on Huffington Post, I do not mind reading those websites. In fact, I try to read those websites when I can. Even Salon. I mean, I try and read. If there's something that is useful, something that I can take and do something with, I mean, these are things that are at our disposal. We should be paying attention to them to know at the very least what the left and the middle are thinking, because the middle, you know, reads a lot of Huffington Post.
The middle they is read there. A lot of that stuff. Where they are. And they are at BuzzFeed.
BuzzFeed.
Yeah.
Just to illustrate your point there, I looked up today, JD gave me the link to look up the, you know, top websites for the United States. Of all the ones that we know that are political, what do you think the number one is?
Probably HuffPo.
Yes, at 25, that's their ranking. Number one is HuffPo. Guess who's close behind that?
BuzzFeed
at 37. You know where Drudge is on that list?
105.
100.
Yeah.
There's a bit of a gap there, it seems.
So we've had, in the conservative movement even, we've had people sparring over whether it's proper to put up a piece on BuzzFeed communities or something like that, or to share articles from HuffPo or Think Progress even. And this is the deal, though. When you have HuffPo and BuzzFeed with vastly larger audiences, wouldn't you want a piece of that?
Right.
Especially if you could reach people there with a thought that maybe they're not going to get anywhere else in their feeds.
Yeah, right.
This is untapped resources. And it to me, it's the equivalent of saying, you know, I'm not going to Think Progress. They're a bunch of liberals, and Slate never has anything. Yes, exactly. It's what JD is doing. It's sticking your fingers in your ears.
La, 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 la.
Exactly. And it doesn't do us any good. And it makes us look like children sticking our fingers in our ears. one of the things we always decry about at college campuses is the speech codes, the free speech zones, where they're trying to curtail the information coming in to the students. And here we do it to ourselves. It's the same thing. We compartmentalize to where we're only getting Fox News. We're only getting a couple of websites, Breitbart and Drudge and whatever. I will tell you one thing. Dave Weigel writes for Slate, and he's one of the reporters I respect the most. I've spoken to him in person, done back and forth with him over different things. That guy is one of my favorite journalists, and he's on the left. You know, he's not radical crazy on the left, but he's a left-leaning writer. But I have found him fair and interesting and well-researched quite a bit. And
it's quarantine. She's got the rhino Ebola. Quarantine her. She's just she's fraternizing with the left. Fraternizer with the left.
To discount Dave Weigel, who is a good guy with real talent and skill and ethics, to discount him because of where his pieces show up, it's merely cutting off your nose to spite your face.
Yeah, I don't like that whole, you know, your logical fallacy is DNA. It's the people who either implicitly trust or mistrust a piece of information based on where it comes from or who said it. I try not to do that. Now, based on my knowledge of the source, I will give their information more or less credibility. I will give them more or less benefit of the doubt. But the location, or you know, the source doesn't necessarily tell me whether it's credible or not.
Well, you know who broke the story about the Houston Equal Rights Ordinance that I saw today, at least from my perspective? WorldNet Daily. Do I go to WorldNet Daily? No. Do I cite WorldNet Daily? No. I don't cite them because they've done things in the past that have proven them to be a sketchy kind of thing. But I will look at the links that they post, and I will follow those links to another source. I'm still getting information from WorldNet Daily, but I'm not sharing it through WorldNet Daily because of its reputation. I'm taking it to another source. I'm waiting till I find a different one that has covered it. That is not the same thing.
I'm not gonna risk my credibility with WND as being the source, but I will use them as a I'll use them as a, you know, a tertiary source, and then track back to the secondary or primary. Absolutely.
Which is what you should be trying to do anyway. You should be trying to figure out, find the you know, originator of the information to make sure that's valid. I mean, that's always what you should be doing.
And likewise, just because there isn't a link to CNN or ABC does not make it invalid. Because I see the flip side where you share a story or you share information that's only reported at The Blaze or at Breitbart, and it's absolutely discounted because you don't have any sources that are ABC or CNN. It's like, well, they're just as likely and unlikely to be true as anybody else.
Right. You know, it's about an individual thing. Going through, read the article. Oh my God, you might have to read an article.
No, that's I just want to look at the picture.
Ten minutes that are wasted there.
I want to react to the headline. What are you talking about? Feelings. It's all about feelings.
Why would you say that to me? Why would you say that, bring up the reacting to headline? You know it's a sore spot for me.
I know.
I'm like, very depressing. Very depressing.
TLDR. Yeah, seriously. People don't even read the headlines anymore. They just look at the picture. Every now and then, you know, I'll share something out, and I'll know that because of the format in which I shared it, the headline, the picture, and the content, you can just tell that none of your commenters clicked the link. None of them read the article. They're just commenting on whatever they're thinking at the time. It's like, you know, whatever, have a good time, guys, but you totally missed the point. It happens, and sometimes it's fun to just watch and say, oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Every now and then, somebody will ask a question that is answered in the article, and I will be a jerk and say, well, in the article it says blah-bitty-blah-bitty-blah, basically calling them out on the comment thread for having not read the article.
Yeah, but they don't care because they've ignored the article altogether. They don't care what it has to say. They don't care about the content. They only care about what they have to say about the content.
Right, so. Right. Their commentary is far more important.
Yes. Oh, this one blogger wrote this thing like a billion years ago that really, really sucked. So permanently now, I disagree with them forever because...
Sure, sure.
I don't know.
Oh, and I did want to, something that I, some note, numbers that I put together earlier this week in looking at audience size on TV news. We tend to get so excited because Fox News has been number one for freaking ever. And we think that's so awesome and it's great. And it's true. Fox News' audience is huge compared to the other cable news shows. But if you look at the total audience of Americans watching news on TV, Fox News gets 10% of them. There is only one moderate to conservative source, and that is Fox News. All of the other sources are liberal. And Fox News gets 10% of the audience. That means 90% of the people out there who are getting news from TV are getting liberal news. And we need to understand that. Because ABC, CBS, and NBC still have huge audiences.
But we're number one.
Yeah.
We're number one. We win. We have Bill O'Reilly and Megyn Kelly and five. We win. We win.
It's true. It's really true. Yeah. We just end up in, I don't know, our little tunnel vision. But life is good in my little bubble, and I don't like reaching out beyond my bubble. Uh-oh, Ryan says he disagrees on our back door chat. Ryan, what do you disagree with? For okay, most so guys, fishy, watching fishy, Megyn Kelly is entertaining.
We need to do some background on that. Fishy said that in our chat here, that Fox doesn't have an entertainment segment not tied to their news angle. So, yeah, there's, you know, you're not watching Fox News for NCIS Fox News. There's no NCIS Fox News as terrible as that. I mean, that probably could be a thing with the trend of horrible NCIS shows. That could be next.
But yeah, people, her point is that people watch ABC because they're waiting for NCIS to start. Or CBS or whatever it is.
Yeah.
So
it's there in the background. They're sitting down to watch something for entertainment value, and then because the TV is still on, they're eventually getting into the news hour shows that, you know, are the number one, you know, that dominate the news side of things outside of cable. On the basic cable stuff, or on whatever, the single-digit channels, it's not even a contest. It's not even close. So.
But yeah, Fishy's reply, Ryan's reply, that for most guys, Fishy was saying that Fox News doesn't have an entertainment section, and Ryan's reply was, well, for most guys, Megyn Kelly is the entertainment section of Fox. Yes, she's very, very pretty.
Speaking of that, that's an excellent transition into the war on women.
Objectification of women, yes.
Hey, I mean it's what we do. It's our milieu. We shouldn't trend away from it. It's one of our principles, right? I'm pretty sure it's written down there in the conservative constitution for Republicans that we have to be somehow, you know, sexist and stuff.
The really funny thing is that Ryan got you guys to say his sexist comment.
True. Oh, my God.
That's why I typed it instead of putting my microphone on.
I've been manipulated. I feel so used. Y'all are just haters.
I mean, Here we go. That's proof in and of itself that the war on women is not over, and the war on women narrative is still, you know, sterling and ready to go, and will, you know, take us down this November. Hopefully not.
No. Now, I actually have been seeing that maybe the war on women is over, and not that, and I think nobody won. I think maybe the actual end of the war on women is going to be a realization that it never really existed and that it was just used as a tool. And I say that because who wrote this article? Maybe it was the editors of National Review.
Yes, it was the editors.
So it was all of them together. They were looking at it and saying, well, if we kind of look at just the Senate races, if we look at a lot of them, we can see that where Democrats have been trying to hype up this war on women, they've kind of been losing. They looked at the Jean Shaheen Scott Brown race in New Hampshire, and apparently the angle that the Democrats used on that one was that Scott Brown is misogynist because he's always running against women. He's always trying to defeat women candidates. Apparently, Scott Brown doesn't want women to hold elective office, so he opposes them or something. I mean, that's just nonsense on stilts. But apparently, that's what they've been saying.
Just like,
he's always campaigning against women. Really?
He's running for the express purpose of keeping them down. He's trying to become the moving glass ceiling right there.
Exactly, because I mean he tried to hold Elizabeth Warren down, you know, and now it's changed. He's a hater. But apparently that's not working all that well because, oddly enough, in New Hampshire, unexpectedly, that race is neck and neck, according to one of the recent polls. And if it's neck and neck now, that means it's totally winnable because they've got 3 weeks to drum up some business and drum up some enthusiasm for Scott Brown. I mean,
Scott Brown doesn't know anything about winning close races late in election seasons.
No, not at all. Other than that's how any of us in America know who Scott Brown is. Huh. Wow, he could actually make this happen, couldn't he?
Well, no, I know about him because he's in, you know, Hunky Dad's monthly, at like every month. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that's his campaign slogan. I'm fairly certain that's what he's running on.
He once did a centerfold in, was it Cosmo or whatever?
I don't remember, but it was something.
Something that he should be more embarrassed about than he is. Yeah. I guess we all had our crazy youth. But anyway, the second war on women race is Allison Grimes versus Mitch McConnell. And, you know, that one should be terrific because we've got this young, successful, wonderful woman who's been the Secretary of State for Kentucky, and she's an executive in this great state versus really just old white man who clearly obviously hates women. But that's not going all that well because they can't really come up with an angle that Mitch McConnell is bad for women because, well, actually, it was Mitch McConnell who was one of the men who authored the Violence Against Women Act. Mitch McConnell actually has...
Whoa. He was for violence against women?
Yes, he was in support of it. He was promoting... Yeah. No. But maybe that's the way they pitch it. It's, yeah, see, Mitch McConnell, he wrote the Violence Against Women Act. Yeah, so he's bad. Uh-huh. No, apparently the voters in Kentucky are not quite as stupid as Allison Grimes wants them to be. And what the news we got today was that the Democrat Senate Campaign Committee has pulled their ads. They are leaving the state. They are deciding that Allison Grimes is on her own. They looked at the whole catching her on her campaign people on mic about lying about coal and thinking Kentuckians are stupid. And then she repeatedly refuses to say who she's voted for president the last two elections. I mean, that's just, again, that, what, why? Yeah.
Leslie, why are you repeating this? Why are you saying these things? You must hate women.
I do. I hate women. I don't want...
Especially Democrat women.
Exactly. I just hate stupid people. Really hate stupid people. Apparently Allison Grimes thinks that it's cool to just lie about stuff for no apparent reason. I mean, I guess lying is her first impulse or something. I mean, somebody asked her if she voted for... They asked her if she voted for Obama during the debate, and she wouldn't answer the question. I mean, how sad is that? But,
and it doesn't just stop in Kentucky.
Yeah.
Colorado.
That's the one that's really pretty exciting to me. Because Mark Udall has, and we talked about this last week, and it'll be great next week when the party of choice comes back, because they are Coloradans. But Mark Udall has basically made his entire campaign about women and abortion and birth control and all those things, and trying to scare everybody that Cory Gardner wants to be all up in your uterus or whatever he's saying. And that's not working either, because the people of Colorado, and this includes the liberal journalists in Colorado,
The Denver Post
came out and has endorsed Cory Gardner. Because Mark Udall is just this one issue thing, talking about an issue that was resolved 41 years ago. It's a, they were saying it's as if Mark Udall doesn't know that life has gone on in the 41 years since Roe versus Wade, and Cory Gardner has actually been talking about the economy and Keystone Pipeline and taxes and things that are of importance to Coloradans. It's awesome. Does anybody know? And last week we were talking about how Cory really needed to respond to Mark Udall's attacks on the whole war on women. Does anybody know if he has or if he did?
Not me. I'm not, you know, as much as we try and pay attention to all of these races, it's almost impossible to get everything from all of them.
Well, and they haven't had a lot of chance to respond, really, to the Denver Post, the changing dynamics, the fact that money is now leaving Colorado, ad buys are also leaving Colorado. It takes a little time to process that. If money is not leaving Colorado, it is now moving to the governor's race. So, you know, that would be where they're retrenching and attempting to, put their assets in places where they can actually do some good. And interestingly, this stage, I don't recall seeing it. I'm probably just not watching it that closely from election to election, but I don't recall seeing publicly at this number of races that a party, any party, is pulling out of this close to an election and saying so, and making it public, or allowing it to be made public. But when you have a huge ad buy and you pull out, and now there's all this ad space available on television, on radio, that gets around. You can't hide that. So even if they're not making it known, they've allowed it to be made known. They've invested the money, they've earmarked it, and now they're pulling it out, and there's spots available. People are going to know that.
It's now that those the only thing that worries me about this. I mean, I'm glad that we're in a better position in Colorado and certainly in Kentucky, and maybe might be able to somehow pull out New Hampshire, but I am a little bit scared that they're pulling the money out of those races to, you know, throw into Kansas or, like, even South Dakota. There's a pseudo independent running. That's their new plan. Apparently, the Democrats have, like, backup plans and backup plans and backup plans, because mm-hmm. they're running pseudo Democrats or independents running as alternatives to Republicans in Kansas and in South Dakota, where you couldn't run a Democrat and win. So, right. You know, these guys are. I'm sure they will be the beneficiaries of some of that money, but it's nice that the War on Women fundraising scheme and greater narrative isn't as effective as it has been in previous years. It's helpful that we haven't had an Aiken moment.
Right.
I mean, my fingers are crossed and you know, knock wood.
Well, we don't have Todd Aiken moments. We have Wendy Davis moments. They have Wendy Davis moments. Good Lord. And
that has been such a painful thing to watch.
Yeah. And you would have thought that the whole War on Women in Texas would have been great because they have Wendy Davis and what's her face, that girl, as the lieutenant governor.
Letitia Vanderpeet.
Vanderpuke or whatever her name is, yeah.
It's so funny. The New Jersey guy knows the lieutenant governor Democrat candidate, and Leslie can't even pull it out.
Because it just doesn't matter. You know, there's information that I store in my brain because it'll matter at some point. That chick's name never got tagged as information.
That's not true. You might have to watch her. She's going to have, unlike Wendy Davis, she will have a future in Texas as a Democrat. Because as much as Wendy Davis has, you know, been a hot mess.
Wendy will have a career out once she leaves the state. She'll go to another state where she can be successful. But yeah,
probably one of the states in my area, and it's probably. Just going to be like, we didn't really need her in Rhode Island. We didn't need her in Connecticut.
That'd be a great place
want her.
But yeah, let's
talk about some quarantine. That everybody's quarantines on everybody's lips. Yes. Let's quarantine the people of Rhode Island. I'll take it.
Yeah. But yeah, Letitia will have a future in Texas Democrat politics. I'm certain of it. As will Anise Parker. Well, no, she'll go out of state too. We can hope. Maybe Letitia will leave the state too. I don't know. But yeah, you would have thought that the whole War on Women thing would have been a better battle for them to have in Texas. That Texas would have been primed for it. But we just totally don't care. Like, eh.
Well, and she's launched her own war on crippled people.
That's true.
That's absolutely right. She should be taking a lot of fire from the Tumblr crowd. She is ableist.
Mm-hmm.
And she is, in fact, the most prominent ableist in politics right now. So.
Well, the great thing is, if here's Andrea Mitchell making a faux pas, talking about the Attorney General for Texas, Abbott, and talking about just making a slip of the tongue because you have people are allegedly doing things until they're proven to have done them in reporting. And she's talking about his supposed disability.
It's like, the supposed? What, honey? There's nothing supposed about it.
Like, he's totally faking.
And no, it's just his choice. It's a different choice that he has made. And we support all choices?
Yes. He's not really disabled. He likes the parking.
Greg Abbott has chosen the wheeled lifestyle rather than the ambulatory lifestyle. It is a valid lifestyle choice.
He is differently ambulatory.
Yeah. Oh, my God. The whole thing is just it's a clown car.
Somebody on one of the share that I made on Facebook, somebody had mentioned, I can't remember who, somebody had mentioned that what the Davis campaign needs to do is send someone to just tip him out of the wheelchair just to expose him.
Oh, my God. We should not be laughing. JD, you better not snip this and publish it.
Greg Abbott, I will tell you, has a very good sense of humor. He would laugh at this as well.
Oh, my God.
Trust I mean, you me. Have to laugh at it because...
You have to because it's so ridiculous.
It's so stupid. It's so stupid. Well, yeah, Andrea Mitchell talking... you know, I can just now hear Andrea Mitchell and Sean Hannity together talking about the race. Andrea's going to talk about Greg Abbott's supposed disability, and Sean Hannity is going to say, no, Greg Abbott is going to literally kick her ass.
That's awesome. That is awesome.
Because Sean always says literally, and yes, well.
Oh,
wouldn't that be great? Great.
No, what's interesting about this business, though, it's just compiling error upon error that it's tone deafness. But what I find really fascinating is when you have the war on women tacked up against Americans with disabilities.
Right. Who wins?
Right. Because it's almost as though you need to have a series of battles among all the left constituencies, the way that JD was talking about the privilege cards, the privilege game a few weeks ago.
Right.
You almost have to have cage matches to determine who wins when you pit left, what is it, left segments against each other. People on the left are thinking, yeah, well, he's been, you know, engaging in this war on women because Wendy Davis says so, and he's doing it from a wheelchair, so that's a different constituency altogether. Does that take some of his privilege points away? It's just amazing what happens when you put contrasting or different liberal constituencies and oppose them together. I mean, pretty soon you're going to have to run on the left only people with, you know, three or four privilege marks against them just to be able to survive.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm pretty sure that Abbott has still is winning the privilege race. I think he's still, I mean, because remember that he is a white man. He would be tall if he could stand. So there's that. Going through the whole list, Wendy is a female and she's a Democrat. So that takes a lot of points in Texas away.
She was a single mother. Was she?
Single mother. We all know that.
Was the guy who paid for her college?
We don't want college graduate that actually takes away some of the points, so that's better off for I mean that makes her score it lessens her overall score. It's a very complicated game, very complicated metric that we have to go through.
I was told there would be no math.
Oh, there's plenty of math. It's that's what makes the game so fun.
And calculus and all of that.
But see, if you use Common Core math...
Oh, no! Common Core! Ah. Help me! Common Core! No!
Yeah.
It's just so nice to see that the war on women has not taken hold in really any of these campaigns. We have not been, most of the commentary that I've been seeing about war on women has been from our side talking about how it's not. I don't even know that I've been seeing that much of the left trying to make a case for the war on women. Haven't really seen it much at all.
Well, we saw it, I mean, we talked about it when there was that thing that Rush said, I don't know, a few weeks ago. And there were emails the next day, like it was nobody waited. It was the next day, and there were emails out, talking about the war on women. But apparently not. Apparently wasn't enough.
Here's what strikes me about that too: when you see Rush Limbaugh that comes up with something to say that tends to allow itself to be painted in a negative light. Okay, we'll just phrase it that way. What do you think people that are already in the left camp do with that information? I think they say, typically, after they've been exposed to this time and time again, I think they say, oh, well, that's Rush being Rush. There's nothing new here. Time to move on. I think you can only use that a certain number of times, and then you have this diminishing utility around it, that there are diminishing returns from using those narratives. And we might be, I don't know, but we might be getting to a point of saturation with the war on women, since it is 2 years out from Aiken, since there haven't been any real crazy candidates this cycle that have said anything ridiculous. It might just be that certain spokespeople from the conservative side are written off as that's just them, and that doesn't excite me anymore. That doesn't move me anymore. I don't know if that's the case, but it's something I'm thinking of a lot lately because of that, well, bring it back to Obama. The whole thing around what has Obama been doing for 6 years is painting conservatives and Republicans as the greatest evil on the planet. And now we have to deal with ISIS, and we have this horrible Ebola problem that's over in Africa that is, you know, working its way here one person at a time. And we have a border issue that's also, you know, very dangerous in a lot of ways. But who are the bad guys in the world? Republicans. Conservatives. And when you waste all your superlatives on something like that, I think you burn through them enough to where you can't use those words, those cards anymore. It's like screaming racism at everything or sexism at everything. At some point, it becomes useless to you.
This is a real role reversal here, because generally I'm the optimistic one and Fishy's the pessimistic one. I don't know that I buy that. I think that the circumstances surrounding the war on women narrative have not been optimal, and they know when they need to use these cards. So right now, the left is all about maximizing their advantage. Until they have the right confluence of events to really start the push, I think that they know when to hold off to keep their powder dry. So while I wish that the war on women was over, and I think we have the ability to end it ourselves by, you know, not saying stupid things and to run more diverse range of candidates, which I think we've done a pretty good job. I mean, we can talk about Monica Wiebe and Joni Ernst. Joni Ernst in and of herself is a, you know, there is no war on women that you can't pull that crap in Iowa, not this year. So, we have the potential to close the door on this really obnoxious and wrong tactic that the left has used, but I don't think that we're quite there yet. Maybe sometime in the future, but, you know.
I'd love to hear what Leslie has to say about it, and Ryan. My final point was that I don't think it's over. I don't think the use of the tactic is over by any means. It's just that I'm finding that the lengths to which it has efficacy is beginning to fade, and I want to make that distinction.
I think you're right there. I think it's starting to fade as a powerful and effective tool, partly because they've used it too often. It's a well that they've gone to too much, and partly because circumstances have overcome them in terms of making out our side to be the worst ever in the world and such a danger to, because the key to the war on women was convincing the left and the people in the middle that the Republicans were the greatest threat. And that's so obviously not true. But, you know, circumstances will change, and the visibility of Ebola and ISIS as threats will fade, and it'll again come around to where Republicans can be made into being the enemy. What I'm hoping, because I can't change what the Democrats do, they're always going to be who and what they are, but I can hope to change, and that's what we try to do for a couple hours every week, I can hope to change how we react to it. And what I'm believing and hoping is that we're getting better at not going, oh my God, every time they throw out War on Women, because a large part of the success of the War on Women has been our reaction as if it was a war and we had to defend against their valid attacks. And once we learn that their attacks are irrational and ho-hum and they happen all the time, we can respond with, oh yeah, that again? What really started to defang the racism claims is us going, yeah, whatever, you're going to call me a racist and then we'll move on to the next thing. And it's the fact that we didn't fight against the bully, we disregarded the bully. And I think if we can, as a political movement, recognize the war on women for the false tactic that it is, and not even respond with, oh yeah, we do so have women candidates, and we do so like, instead of arguing back against their points, that's actually acting as if their points are valid. By disagreeing with them, we're agreeing that they were valid in the first place. Instead, if we get better at just being dismissive and rejecting the whole premise of the war on women, absolutely reject it and disregard it and move on to the next thing and be very dismissive and scoff at them or even laugh at them.
Well, and that ties in what Andy said last week about taking away their big firepower, neutralizing it, and then moving on to your points. You know,
right.
When we talked about fighting, you know, actually putting up a fight, that's exactly, I mean, it's the same thing that goes along with that. If you show up and you call them on it and say, you know, you're being ridiculous, here's why, and now we're going to talk about serious issues, there you go. I think you have the opportunity. And I wouldn't necessarily say, oh, you know, women, you don't have a serious concern, because, of course, they want to feel as though they are listened to and understood, and that's a very important part of the process. But you still have to fight that narrative, but you don't, you know, belabor that point. You address it, you hit it, you neutralize it, and you move on.
Right. Me disagreeing with your points is, I'm not disagreeing with you because you're a woman, I'm disagreeing with you because I disagree with your points. Now let's talk about Keystone XL Pipeline. Let's talk about, and I think that may be what Cory Gardner did with Mark Udall, is not dismiss the accusations, but say, no, that's not at all what I was saying. Let's talk about taxes. Let's talk about fracking. Let's talk about all of these other important things.
Let's hope that's what he's done. It didn't sound like it from last week's show. It sounded like he was not even addressing him and just saying that's, you know, Udall was a one-issue candidate. And that is what the Denver Post parroted back when they were writing their endorsement of Gardner. But that said, at least he's in a stronger position now and has had people telling him that. And maybe the momentum can sort of keep going and we can see Gardner Senate. I don't know.
Yeah, that'd be cool. That would be cool. What's really so neat in looking at the candidates and looking at their websites, like I've been doing for the advertisement thing, so many of them are young. And I love that. Cory Gardner is young, and they have that optimistic, happy, future-oriented just look about them. And Tom Cotton, the Senate candidate from Arkansas, who is the Army Ranger, he's a young guy, looks very, you know, has that young, youthful optimism stuff. Okay, yeah, and then there's Jeff Bell, who is, what, 70 years old.
Who's also the only candidate that we've interviewed on the Conservative Union. So we like Jeff Bell just fine.
Absolutely.
Bell, Grandpa with the gold standard, we're fine. We're good. We're working on it.
He was in the Reagan era. Come on.
If we could get some money here in New Jersey, we could be able to do a whole lot with it. I mean,
that's another great thing, just to hit on this positive note on the way out. At NRO, there was another piece today. I can't remember who wrote it, but it was a great piece about the RNC just gave, what is it, $4 million to to the NRSC, the National Republican Senatorial Committee, to spend, and that's $4 million they didn't have budgeted anywhere for anything, and now right 3 weeks before the election, they have that to spend on Senate races. it probably wouldn't do Cory Gardner as much good, or Mitch McConnell as much good, or even Scott Brown as much good as it would do Jeff Bell, who's doing as well as he is with very little investment and no television buys.
Quinn Hillier is who wrote it over.
Thank you.
Yeah, that was a neat article. And when you're looking at, as Quinn mentioned in the article, when you're looking at found money, and do you use it as an extra 5% of what you were going to spend on a race that we're figuring will win by 1%, or do you say, I am going to double the amount of money that Jeff Bell has spent? Because Jeff Bell has only ever spent like $300,000 so far. If the NRSC gives him another $300,000 that he wasn't expecting to have in the last 3 weeks, when people in New Jersey have not been paying any attention, and there are people in New Jersey who have just always assumed it would be Cory Booker because they've been told, like all of us have been told, that New Jersey is a Democrat state. Well, what if all of a sudden they woke up and saw an ad on TV? What? There actually is a Republican candidate? Oh, well, and oh my gosh, he's not an idiot. And he's a serious candidate. Well, that's interesting. Maybe I will go vote.
And
so there is a Republican Party in New Jersey? Huh. Who knew?
Can you imagine the looks on the faces of Democrats nationwide if Cory Booker were not to be returned to the Senate? Can you taste it?
Oh my God. Oh my God.
By of all people, by Jeff Bell.
It would be so awesome. I really want that to happen.
We should. This is. It's like buying a lottery ticket with excellent odds. I mean, the amount of return that you get for even the smallest amount. I mean, we're a tiny state, comparatively speaking. We, you know, an ad buy goes a long way for us here. It's expensive, mm-hmm. but it goes a long way. So.
But yeah, $400,000 of, and that's what they got, $4 million. So
just double him. Just double up what he's had. Come on. I mean,
$1,000, but anything.
The shockwaves and the entertainment value alone are worth it.
If he makes it within 3 points of Cory Booker, it would be worth it. Make Cory spend the rest of his money. I mean, Cory only has $3 million left.
Yeah, I mean, make it. There's so much to be gained by investing in those races that you, or, you know, and throw some money at Michigan. Why not? Why the hell not? That would be so cool. And, you know, that would give us something fun to look at for the next 3 weeks.
And I want to say Ted Cruz, if I'm not mistaken, is like vice chair of the NRSC.
Oh, is he?
Or something like that. He's on that. He's in that group. He's on that committee. So anybody with connections there, put a bug in his ear.
Yeah, that would be awesome. Because, you know, Ted's out there stumping for Pat Roberts, who's another old guy that we want to send back to the Senate. And I guess Pat Roberts today was on Fox, and he even said, hey, send me back to Washington so that we can retire Harry Reid. I mean, he absolutely understands the program. He says, you know, you got to get me rather than Orman so that Harry Reid can go away. It's a strategic, tactical thing. But the Pat Roberts campaign has got enough marquee value that he's getting money from the Karl Rove Group and Freedom Works, and Ted Cruz is doing donation drives. You know, Pat Roberts is getting enough money. Jeff Bell doesn't have anybody over there doing that for him.
He's got Steve Forbes and Larry Kudlow. I mean, they gave a fundraiser for him 9 months ago.
Cool.
9 months ago.
That was a little too long.
Nine months ago.
Yeah, 9 months ago. Can we say 9 months ago?
It was a while back, and I'm pretty sure he used all of that in the primary to, you know, it's outrageous that we don't really support our northeastern candidates as well as we should. But I will get off of my my soapbox here because we probably should end the end the episode on an up note, not on a, these Republicans.
No. There is so much good news out there. There are warnings that the Democrats have their ground game together better than we do. They always have a better ground game than us. So we have to partly compete on that and partly find other ways to find our victory. And that means we have to start talking to people we don't normally talk to about politics and doing more than you're used to, and it does mean resharing these posts that are promotional advertisements for candidates, not horse race posts about this is how I think this candidate is doing, but promotional posts about candidates. Start being a salesperson, you know, be that carnival barker, and also resharing the snips. Sure, you can share the whole two-hour episode of The Refiner, and we are, in fact, working on a way to have that be a podcast that people can download and subscribe in iTunes. I'm working on it. But mostly, we have a 5 or 6 minute snippet every day that will be the best 5 minutes that you've ever spent for that day in learning about conservative messaging or sports things that JD cares about that I don't. Am I the only one who pretends to pay attention when JD starts talking sports? Because I just kind of zone out.
I have to make a distinction. If he's using a sportsing analogy, I'm all about the sportsing analogy. I love that because it reaches people. But when he's just talking sports and talking smack with Andy, I'm pulling out my novel and I'm reading it.
You do understand that people think of politicsing. Don't you feel offended with that concept there? Don't you feel belittled that this thing that you pay so much attention to, that we all pay so much attention to, is you know, put into that kind of no.
Yeah, not really. Not really.
Although, right, you know, seeing the sausage made sometimes, it must be like watching, camps or something when you're, you know, evaluating players. I'm trying. I'm reaching out.
It's okay. Thank you. I appreciate it. We'll work on this. We'll work on this in the off season later.
Off season.
After the election is over.
But didn't we already discuss that there's no such thing as an off season when you're in?
Thank you.
But there's a difference in. Never mind. Just never mind. We'll figure out the sports analogies better.
He is now on special teams.
Which is different from the special bus and the special ed class. The special ed classes are for me.
Oh, man.
Okay, it's time to... And that will conclude episode 18 of The Refinery. Thank you guys for hanging in there with us. And through all of the silliness. And we will be back next week, Tuesday at 8:30 Central. In the meantime, during this week, promote all of your GOP candidates and watch and share all of the clips from The Refinery. Thank you.
find your local GOP office and volunteer, because that's important, and you should find your local candidates and volunteer for them as well. So do that.
Very much so. Thank you, guys.